Friday, 5 p.m., another week rolls to an end. Another weekend on the horizon. Time for American Hit Radio on 90.3 WHPC. I'm your host, Tom Ryan, my lovely wife and co-host, Heidi Morales-Ryan, here as well.
I want to rock.
Well, we'll rock. We're going to rock in an old school way, yeah. I suppose. This is amazing, but this is part 10 in our series dedicated to Duke Ellington. We are up to the year 1938 in his career. There's quite a ways to go. But I don't think I'm trying to fatten this out. I'm not padding this out. I mean, I'm trying to cover songs that I think are relevant.
Yeah, you're covering the basics.
In fact, there's a lot to cover now, so I'm going to try to keep talk to a minimum as much as I can.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah. But as the 30s drew to a close, like I said, we're around 1938 here, so did Duke Ellington's relationship with his manager, Irving Mills. They parted amicably, citing artistic differences for the split, which in this case was more or less true. Ellington wanted freedom to pursue his muse wherever it led, while Mills wanted Ellington to focus his energy entirely on commercial music. Ellington felt, correctly as it turns out, that he could have it both ways. And the music from this show demonstrates Ellington reaching beyond the standard fare of the day. From here on, there were going to be some big changes made. So Duke is already, at this point in time, not so much aiming for hits as much as aiming for music that's going to satisfy himself.
Yeah.
And I'd also wanted to use this opportunity as a chance to maybe read from a couple of little snippets from Duke's book before each song where he introduces his own band members.
Nice.
Little stories and such. And before we play the first track, I think we could tell a story. We've already talked about Bubba Miley, who's already come and gone, so I can skip that story. But Joe Tricky Sam Nanton. I love that name.
Yeah, that's a great name.
Right? Exactly. Was a band member. He was one of the trombonists in the band and pretty much played on just about all the stuff that the big band played. In fact, he'll be playing on this next track. And here's what Ellington's got to say about him. Tricky Sam, Joe Nanton, was a youngster who made it to all the joints around Harlem where you could hear the music people who insisted on calling jazz. He had really never had his coming out party, and he had never found a place to fit on a full-time basis, nor had he found a true running mate. He'd carry his horn around from one joint to another and get to play a chorus here and a chorus there. What you should know is that he was of West Indian heritage. So he had a way of playing that was very unusual from what most other trombonists might have been playing. Imagine somebody with like a West Indian sort of a ska feel playing trombone, which is a very big instrument, but playing for Duke Ellington. He says, before Tricky joined us, Charlie Irvis, who was known as Charlie Plug, was our original trombone player. He was called Plug because of the device he used on his horn. In those days, they manufactured a kind of mute designed to make the trombone sound like a saxophone.
Oh.
At that time, the sax was still regarded as a new instrument. Charlie had dropped this device and broke it, so he used what was left of it, rolling it around in the bell of his trombone. He couldn't use it the way it was intended because of the part broken off, but he'd get this entirely different, lecherous, low tone, and no one has ever done it since.
That's cool.
You might say that there was really a lost art there. When Charlie left and we got Tricky, it was exactly the opposite, because everything he did was up the top of the horn. Luckily, we had Bubba Miley as his plunger mate. If you think of East St. Louis Tootaloo, that was Bubba who came up with that stuff.
Right.
Tricky had been using the plunger before, and he had all those sounds, but they were a little too sophisticated to be appreciated by the average listener who would walk into a jam session. By sophisticated, I mean that he had had to devise a technique because those sounds had to be precise. There were certain distances the plunger had to be away from the mute inside the bell, and there was the matter of when you squeezed it. There were certain tones and a certain pitch that were relevant. All these people were valuable to me because each one's effective range or scope was limited. This is how Ellington would write for his band. Okay, first song up. This is called Harmony in Harlem on American Hit Radio, 90.3 WHPC. You know, that makes me happy to hear that song right now.
Oh, that totally has such a good vibe to it.
Harmony in Harlem. You know what I think, Heidi? Because, I mean, well, you know, during 2020, the whole COVID era, while we were doing our pop music series from 55 to 69, and that was so much fun, but it was kind of easy for me. I didn't have to do a lot of work. So I used that opportunity, as you know, to start doing research for my Duke Ellington period that I knew was coming up. I knew I was going to have to do Duke and had a lot of homework to do because I knew his music, but I didn't know it deep. I knew it peripherally.
Right.
So for like 7 or 8 months, I played like, it seems like, you know, almost nothing but Duke Ellington.
Oh, you've been totally immersed.
And I mean,
luckily, it's such a great catalog.
It's incredible. I mean,
I didn't mind it. It wasn't like when you forced me to listen to everything Frank Zappa ever did.
Well, I know that there were times that it could try your patience, like it would anybody. I mean, I just looked at the number. I collected over 1,100 Duke Ellington's recordings, and I listened to each of them probably 3 or 4 times. That's an insane amount of Duke Ellington.
Did I complain?
I only remember times when there were like lulls in, because, you know, that's a lot of Duke. And you know, and not all of it is as fantastic, but that was the whole point. That's why I was listening over and over again. I wanted to grab the best bits.
We were duking it out.
Yeah, we duked it out. I like that. Very cute.
Uh-huh.
And we ended up with the songs that are part of the series. And, you know, normally Harmony in Harlem is a song that probably would have been overlooked. But it, you can hear the genius of it and the fabulous, the fabulousness of the players that, and Duke writing for them.
Yeah.
As you had just said.
Definitely captured their fortes.
Like this next track that we're going to play, it's called Jubilesta, and it was written with the help of Juan Tizol. Now, we spoke about this in depth last week. We talked about, we actually read Duke's bit on Juan, and we also talked about the writing credit thing that went back and forth.
Yeah.
Well, this is one that, you know, Juan did get credit for good reason. But I'll take this opportunity to talk about the band's, well, what Duke talked about, the band's guitar player, Freddie Guy. This is going to sound crazy, but back then you might be surprised to even hear that Duke had a guitar player in his band.
Yeah.
Like, what? You don't
jazz guitar, though.
The job of a guitar player back then was, this is going to sound really weird, it was almost to be like a tuneful tambourine, because what the guitar player would do was hold tempo. Really, really hard, you know, it was his job, because he'd be playing rhythm very, you know, very strong and heavy, more than the bass player.
Wow.
Okay. Maybe even more than the drummer. So, but he was obviously doing it not only in a rhythmic way, but in a tuneful way. So anyway, here's what Duke has to say about it. Freddie Guy was born in Georgia, but he had been in New York most of his life when he joined us in 1925, and he knew Harlem backwards and forwards. He was rather a serious type of fellow and was always giving us advice, but his guitar was a metronome and the beat was always where it was supposed to be. He was a good man at managing finances, too. Herman Stark, the manager of the Cotton Club, used to say to me, "You're going to be famous star, but Freddie Guy is going to wind up with all the money." We first met him when he was the leader of a small band that played in a joint on 135th Street that was owned by Earl Dancer. He had Fats Waller in the band and a beautiful chick named Angelina Rivera, who was a fine violinist. They allowed us the privilege of sitting in and participating in the music and the tips. All over Harlem, there were only great, hospitable people to welcome us to New York. As I said, written with help from Juan Tizol, the name of this track is Jubilesta on American Net Radio, 90.3 WHBC. Thank you. another sleeper classic. I mean, there's so much great music from this era in the late 30s. But I got to tell you also, just, you know, hold on to your hats, because this is just a precursor for what's to come.
It's beautiful.
You know, this show is part 10, but part 11, 12, 13 are just going to be like, there's so much action that happens in the early 40s. But let's move on. Next musician that Duke will be giving us a story about is Harry Carney. He was the lone baritone sax player of the band. And well, here's what Duke says about him. Harry Carney was just 17 years old.
Whoa.
When he first came to me in 1927.
A youngin.
Right. He owned a car and all his own instruments, and already had $6,000 in the bank. He started playing with us while on his summer vacation, which of course was the time of year when he made all of his money. Through systematic saving, he should be in very good shape now. A very well-behaved, well-organized young man, he was immediately nicknamed Youth by Sonny Greer, band's drummer. He invited us to his home in Boston, where he claims Freddie Guy and Duke Ellington conned his beautiful mother, Mrs. Jenny Carney, a lovely lady and a good cook known for her warm hospitality, into letting him come with us instead of going back to school. He's a little fatter now, but he still looks like his nickname. All right, I'm going to play two tracks in a row here, because this is, again, the thing that was exactly causing the rift between Duke and Irving Mills. Duke wanted to revisit one of his older hit compositions, Black and Tan Fantasy, by expanding on it.
Cool.
He wrote an entire introduction, for example, that is quite naturally called Prologue to Black and Tan Fantasy. And he wrote that in order to segue into what he now calls New Black and Tan Fantasy. And I don't think you'll be disappointed. On Americanet Radio 90.3 WHPC, here are both of those tracks back to back.
Thank you.
a remake of a classic with some unbelievable clarinet playing by Barney Bogard on that track. Just fabulous on both of those tracks, but on part two in particular.
Oh, yeah.
Which is appropriate because the next artist that that Duke wants to introduce you to happens to be Barney Bogard. Again, I'm taking these from his book called Music Is My Mistress. Barney Bogard and Wilman Broud, when they were in the band, Wilman Broud's out at this point, were a fountain of stories about New Orleans. Both of them were from there. And now and then they would take off in their French patois. Naturally, they both claimed Creole heritage. And they would elaborate on all the things that the New Orleans Chamber of Commerce would have liked to have heard. They would talk of old days, even before their time, calling names, very colorful names, like Buddy Bolden and King Oliver.
Nice.
And they would have a lot to say about the marching bands and the second line. Even today, one never hears too much about the second line, which is the name given to fans who dance attendance on the bands as they proceed through the streets. Everything they talked about and played was the purest old jazz, and they were forever making comparisons between New York cats and the jazz clan of New Orleans. It all sounded so good and so romantic that I was ready to catch the next train. Finally, in the middle 30s, we went to New Orleans, and it was very much like they had said. So we felt rather at home with the crawfish and the gumbo filet.
Yum, yum.
Because Bogard and Broud were in the band with us, thousands of people were at the station in New Orleans when the train arrived. The two musicians had first name exchanges with the crowd, and we felt that it was because of them that we were received with such warm hospitality.
How lovely.
Beautiful. All right. Next track up in the series, this is called The Gal from Joe's on American Net Radio, 90.3 WHBC.
Thank you.
I will be honest. I will say this. I mean, after I had worked all those months on selecting my songs for Duke Ellington, the songs that I really felt that I wanted to play for artistic reasons, I decided to let the hit parade play a role as well. And I went through the Pop Memories book. And if there was a song that Ellington had as a chart hit, I thought that that was an appropriate way to move the show along as well. So I allowed them into the program. And that's exactly, that is the reason why
that's
we just
heard. That's quite a number of songs.
Well, I had to add maybe another 10 or so, because I did have a pretty, most of the hits are incredible. But you know, I think Gal from Joe's is one of those songs that I probably didn't choose. But okay, it was a number 20 hit in 1938. So there it is. In fact, the next track we're going to play is another that falls into that exact same category. But the next one was a number 10 hit called If You Were In My Place, What Would You Do? But before playing it, let's meet another character. Who's up next? This time it would be Johnny Hodges. One of Duke's saxophone players from the band, and of which he had many. As a youngster, Johnny Hodges was a saxophonist in Boston whose style, in the estimation of all other alto saxophonists, was unique. Even now, I have never yet met and don't know of a saxophonist who didn't say he was knocked out by Johnny Hodges. As I originally told Stanley Dance years ago, Johnny Hodges has complete independence of expression. He says what he wants to say on the horn, and that is it. He says it in his language, which is specific, and you could say that that, his, is pure artistry. He's the only man I know who could pick up a horn and play in tune without tuning up. And I've heard plenty of cats who can't play in tune after they tune up all day.
I am.
Here's If You Were In My Place on American Radio 90.3 WHBC. Thank you. Okay, so there we heard a track from 1938, two tracks, one from that reached number 20 on the pop charts, the next that reached number 10, which is what we just heard. Pretty straightforward pop. Now, this next song was a number one song from 1938. But here is an excerpt from the book Duke Ellington's America by Harvey G. Cohen, which I think you might find interesting before you hear this song. By 1938, it was clear that Ellington, armed with his successes of the past 12 years, committed even more strongly than before to producing work that often fell outside the usual popular music experience. Rather than recycling the catchiest riffs clothed in the same musical phrasing throughout a recording, Ellington's main themes are often subtly developed in a way that moves them forward through the piece without overt repetition, rewarding the attentive listener with varying shades and nuances. The songs and arrangements are designed as if they are telling a story with the beginning, middle, and end, rather than calling attention to the fact that a potential hit record is being presented. They betray the touch of a composer, as well as that of a songwriter and arranger. The lengthy intervals Ellington used in his melodies, as especially seen in I Let a Song Go Out of My Heart, also favored a composer's or instrumentalist's aesthetic, as they made these songs more difficult for singers to perform than the usual pop song. Most non-Ellington cover versions of I Let a Song Go Out of My Heart give the song a happy lilt, but the Ellington Orchestra's original version is a more bittersweet affair, especially in its minor key bridge and in some of Johnny Hodges and Bonnie Burgard's counterpoint surrounding the melody. While most swing-era bands aimed for the profitable youth demographic, Ellington, at least 10 years older than most of his bandleader peers, often reflected a more adult sensibility in his love songs that recognized both good and sad times, sometimes simultaneously, instead of sugar-coated imagery of love. On American Radio 98.3, here is I Let a Song Go Out of My Heart.
Heart. Believe me, darling, when I say I want no sweet music until you return someday.
I can keep this next introduction relatively short because we had just talked about Johnny Hodges moments ago with Duke, you know, talking about how he would be able to pick up a horn that wasn't even in tune and play it perfectly in tune. while others wouldn't be able to, you know, would try all day and they couldn't even play a horn that wasn't tuned. And this next song is a showcase for Johnny Hodges and a really fun and interesting and cool one at that. It's called Jeep's Blues on American Net Radio, 90.3 WHPC. If that song sounds familiar to you, those of you who may know the album Ellington at Newport from 1955, that appears on that album. Duke brought that back for that best-selling album of his from the, maybe it was 56, excuse me, Ellington at Newport in 56. Yes, I think it was 56. Anyway, here's another great, I'd rather have Harvey Cohen do the talk because I like the way that he discusses this track in particular. During 1938, the last year of the Ellington-Mills relationship, there are numerous examples of Ellington recordings that deviated from commercial guidelines. Stepping into Swing Society opens with three simple and fetching horn riffs that could have appeared on a recording by someone like Kay Kaiser, a more conservative, best-selling bandleader of the day. On most swing-era discs, those riffs would constantly repeat over the course of the three-minute record, with solos grafted on top. Hmm. But following the first minute of Swing Society, Ellington's arrangement deconstructs the opening theme to a nearly unrecognizable degree, transforming it at one point into a riff that seems to laugh at the listener, hoping for more predictability in the piece. Other bridge sections follow, none explicitly tied to the original riffs, including a slightly disconcerting minor key section that lends a momentary darker tone, a favorite Ellington device. Finally, with only 30 seconds remaining, the opening motif returns. Swing Society is highly enjoyable, but was obviously not a ringer for airplay on your hit parade. Here's a good example of what we're talking about, and try to see if you can hear a little bit of what Harvey Cohen is talking about on American Net Radio 90.3 WHPC. Here is Steppin' Into Swing Society. There's a lot of genius that's flowing through, and it's so comfortable in its presentation. It's also interesting to note that a lot of the songs that were recorded were not always credited to Duke Ellington and his famous orchestra. For example, I'm going to play two tracks here back to back that, like Jeep's Blues, which we played previously, are credited to Johnny Hodges and his orchestra.
Why is that?
Johnny Hodges basically took the band and would get recording sessions, and they ended up with a pared down version of Duke's band.
Ah.
And Duke would let Johnny, you know, basically lead the band. So they'd come down to, let's see, Cootie Williams, Lawrence Brown, Johnny Hodges, of course, Otto Hardwick, Harry Carney, Duke, of course, on piano, Billy Taylor, Sonny Greer. So they end up with an eight-piece as opposed to Duke's band, which is usually at least
humongous.
Twice that size.
Yeah.
And that's what these next two tracks are. Credited to Johnny Hodges and his orchestra, we're going to hear Rendezvous with Rhythm and A Lesson in C on American Hit Radio. That's C, the letter C, on American Hit Radio 90.3 WHPC.
Lesson in C.
I should clarify, or more accurately correct, one of my statements before I played those two songs. I mentioned that Johnny Hodges and his orchestra would basically sometimes get the credit, which was true. I mean, that was for Jeep's Blues and Rendezvous with Rhythm. They were credited to Johnny Hodges and his orchestra. However, A Lesson in C was credited to Cootie Williams and his Rug Cutters with pretty much the same lineup, the same bunch of people. Now, okay, we got time for one more track, a track that is actually Duke Ellington and his famous orchestra. And so we'll introduce this with one more band member who actually was somebody who did not make the cut with Johnny Hodges or the Cootie Williams Orchestra, but nevertheless, a trumpet player from Duke's band from around this time named Freddie Jenkins. Freddie Jenkins came to us from Wilberforce University in 1928. He had no bad habits, and thanks to his college years, he was a perfect gentleman who dropped the right names of all the right people in Ohio. He was a good reader, but he developed an extra dimension that earned him the nickname of Posey. It really began with his sitting at the end of the trumpet section. He brought us a new kind of sparkle. His every move was a picture in the groove and right on top of the action. Even a cliche in his solos had an extra unique flair, a personality play. He was total theater. He dressed flashily, almost foppishly, and gained the attention veteran vaudevillians strove for and bragged about whenever they attained it. Posey's showmanship was unforgettable. People still ask, whatever happened to that wonderful left-handed trumpet player who used to sit out there at the end? He never lived in any of the many violent ways open to musicians, but he had to be seen standing on the corner at all hours of the day with his big cigar saying, "What's happening, man?" All right, we'll wrap this up then with this final track called "I'm Slapping 7th Avenue with the Soles of My Shoes" in honor of you, Freddie Jenkins. Thanks for listening to American at Radio 90.3 WHPC. We'll see you next week, folks. Thank you.